Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today on this 11th anniversary of 9/11, we will begin with Colleen Rowley, a former FBI special agent who pushed to investigate the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui, before the 9/11 attack. We will discuss the latest revelations of a hidden body of memos and intelligence briefs that preceded the infamous August 9th CIA Delhi brief, Bin Laden determined to strike in US, that makes it clear how culpable the Bush White House was for not preventing 9/11 and how negligent they were in ignoring repeated specific warnings. Then we go to Moscow to speak with the editor of a popular science magazine who was fired for not covering Putin's stunt flying with the cranes. Marcia Gessen, the author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, joins us to discuss the ongoing struggle of brave Russians standing up to an increasingly repressive leader who continues to dramatically reverse freedom of expression and the legal, civil, and human rights of Russians. Then finally, we'll examine the latest attempt by the Wall Street banking lobby to undo the Dodd-Frank post-2008 reforms. Amit Narang, public citizens regulatory policy advocate and editor of the Administrative Law Review, joins us to discuss how a bipartisan group of senators are pushing a poison pill bill posing as financial reform that will enable Wall Street to smother attempts at oversight with endless delays through litigation. Joining us now on the 11th anniversary of 9/11 is Colleen Rowley, a former FBI special agent who investigated Italian organized crime and Sicilian heroin smuggling, then in 1990 was transferred to Minneapolis, where she pushed to investigate the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. In 2002, she brought some of the pre-9/11 lapses to light and testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee about endemic problems facing the FBI and the intelligence community. Time magazine named her and two others whistleblowers persons of the year. She retired from the FBI in 2004 and now speaks publicly on ethical decision-making and balancing civil liberties with the need for effective investigation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colleen Rowley.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I've always been puzzled by the extent to which those high up in our government who were given information about an impending attack, specifically the president, the vice president, the National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, the head of the FBI, Louis Freeh, and others who were given information that an attack was impending and for various reasons ignored these attacks. Now, Kurt Eichenwald has written a book and has an article in the New York Times, The Deafness Before the Storm, that indicates that the famous August the 6th, 2001 memo titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the U.S. is only the tip of the iceberg, that preceding memos in the president's CIA daily briefing were far more specific and far more alarming. And so the body of evidence is great out there that's previously been kept under wraps by the Bush White House of their culpability in ignoring these threats.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that it's taken 11 years for the truth, snippets of the truth at least, to slowly dribble out. Last year, there was actually other revelations that came out on the 10th anniversary about memos that afterwards officials claimed never to have even read, that were of the same nature, that basically there was one memo in the FBI that said Bin Laden and Ibn Khattab are determined to attack, very similar to what Eichenwald is referring to in these later summer memos.
So did the White House just selectively... And they did it under pressure from the 9/11 Commission to release this August the 6th intelligence briefing warning, Bin Laden determined to strike the U.S. I guess that's ended up being damage control, right, for them. And then they managed to successfully keep the rest of the memos that preceded it, which are far more alarming and much more specific, from the public.
They fought the truth coming out tooth and nail. And at the same time as they were fighting the truth of basically these were such simple, Eichenwald calls it negligence, but I think it's more like recklessness. This was reckless ignoring of warnings that were coming out, and it was more than one thing. It was coming from every direction. The stuff that came in that summer of 9/11 that we now know about is just mind-boggling. And from the top down, yes, there was little interest on the part of the Bush administration. You've seen this You've seen this actually been revealed now slowly, but, you know, Condi Rice puts off Richard Clark. Ashcroft lists terrorism as his lowest priority in August of 2001, telling the FBI that they've got a ratchet up violent crime program. So you've seen this, and of course, the Bush administration, this is interesting that these other memos existed, and Eichenwald is quoting from these earlier summer memos, and perhaps, I don't know if there will be any public pressure at this point to produce those actual memos. Let's hope that the press can get some pressure on, but, you know, frankly, the public, after what, how many wars, 2-3 wars, the creation of a police national security surveillance state, overturning the Geneva Conventions, I mean, all of the various things that the Bush administration told the public was the answer to 9/11 without telling the public what the truth of their own terrible recklessness was in ignoring this. That, of course, now is almost water under the bridge at 11 years, and people don't really know how to handle the truth. I think there's a problem now with so many terrible actions, false solutions that occurred after 9/11, that people are in a way vested in this false myth. So I hope that we can get the truth out, and obviously it will slowly come out, but it's been a very sad episode to live through.
And again, I'm speaking with Colleen Rowley, former FBI special agent who pushed to investigate the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. And
well, let me just stop. It was the agents in our Minneapolis office. We had a couple of extremely astute agents, one who was a pilot and actually was in intelligence, and he had a very few years in. That's why people didn't necessarily take their information seriously either, but the agents were the ones. I was just the legal person in the office. I was the legal counsel. And afterwards, the Bush administration, top down, used the legal reasoning as a pretext. They claimed that the law did not allow them to adeptly investigate terrorism. And of course, that's one of the reasons why you've seen the warrantless monitoring. All of these illegal actions are part of this idea that the law was a constraint. And it never was. It never was. It was completely false. But my memo was mostly on that level, how these were simply human errors, mostly failure to read documents. It's incredible that the Inspector General and the Joint Intelligence Committee, and as shoddy as it was, even the 9/11 Commission, recognized that simple reading of these key memos. Afterwards, these officials claim they never read these memos. Even that of sharing information between the CIA and the FBI would have stopped 9/11. And certainly if the Bush administration had indicated any serious concern about these terrible warnings that bin Laden was determined to attack, none of this would have happened. But because the public and the citizenry was not allowed to know what the true mistakes and failures were, and what was all covered up, the 9/11 Commission, after 3 years, did put out a part of this, but very small. They were not able to get at the truth either, partly because the Bush administration fought them. But now, of course, the sad thing is that, like I said, all of these false solutions were immediately put into play. You start to see, for instance, Cheney talking about using torture within weeks. You start to hear them saying, or within, I think, just a few days, they're talking about going into Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11. So you see all of these very, very false solutions to 9/11 being undertaken within days and weeks of 9/11, and the public had no idea what was going on.
Well, apparently, Colleen Rowley, from intelligence officials, that we've now learning that it was the neoconservative leaders who had recently assumed power at the Pentagon. They had got the president's ears and were warning the White House that the CIA had been fooled and that bin Laden was merely pretending to be planning an attack to distract the administration from Saddam Hussein, who, of course, was the real target of the neoconservatives. And eventually, they obviously were able to convince Bush to go to war against a secularist who, in the real world, would never have had anything to do with an Islamic fundamentalist.
Well, and in fact, he was kind of an enemy of the 9/11 of Osama bin Laden. So, in fact, what we did was created by taking down Saddam Hussein, and of course, stirring up all the trouble. People used to say you were going to be hitting a hornet's nest in the Mideast. Now that actually has backfired. There are actually al-Qaeda new groups that are at least affiliated with al-Qaeda that are working in some of these Syria and other uprisings right now. So, and especially with the drone bombing in Afghanistan and Pakistan, there are many experts that now say al-Qaeda is on the rise. So, you know, 11 years later, the longest wars, I think, in our history at least, and to see this kind of constant incompetence and worse than incompetence, it's all through deceit. I blame it all on lack of information sharing and secrecy, because if the public and if key officials in the intelligence committees knew the truth, none of this would have happened. And frankly, even now, we could still stop some of the dumbest things that are going on. But there's a lot of secrecy, and it's just the opposite of what the fix is. If you realize that the failure to connect the dots was due to agencies not sharing information with each other, and Eichenwald, I think, is perfectly right about this. These neocons wanted to control, and they were some key positions that they had their theories, of course, completely wrong, but they had their pre-agenda in mind. And so when facts come along that are different from their previous agenda that they want to put into place, they just ignore those facts. And so the answer would be less secrecy. And I don't think the Obama administration, frankly, understands that either. They've actually increased secrecy and prosecuted whistleblowers and the like, too. A lot of this is just because they think they should be able to control what the public knows. But this is absolutely dangerous, what we're doing, continuing to do.
Again, I'm speaking with Colleen Rowley, a former FBI special agent who in 2002 brought some of the pre-9/11 lapses to light and testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee about endemic problems facing the FBI and the intelligence community. And we're talking about some of the latest information that's come from Kurt Eichenwald's research indicating that there were many, many more and much more damning and alarming memos and intelligence briefs that the White House had about an impending attack by bin Laden, and even specifically saying that the terrorist groups were actually in the United States planning an operation and that the al-Qaeda strike would be imminent. All of this was ignored by the White House. And obviously, one of the things that I find sort of ironic and somewhat infuriating, Colleen, is that the 9/11 truthers have muddied the water here with all of their absurd theories, and they've essentially let Bush and Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and Louis Freeh off the hook by suggesting that somehow they were all evil geniuses who wanted bin Laden to attack in order to rescue their failed presidency, when in fact the real story is clear that these people have gotten away with the worst negligence in American history, and they should be absolutely pilloried for their incompetence. That is their primary job of a president and an executive branch, is to protect the United States. That's their number one mission, and they failed.
Yeah, well, I totally agree. When you say the word truther, what I agree with is that the full truth, yes, some has dribbled out over the last 11 years. But I do agree that the full truth has yet to still come out because, for instance, there's been a big black area between why the CIA, they've never been allowed to tell the truth. The CIA was tracking two of the terrorist suspects for, I think, over a year, and they knew they had come into California. And yet, to this day, we don't know why the CIA never told the FBI about that. We don't know, for instance, George Tenet, who was one of the key hubs and did read these memos and did all of the memos that Eichenwald is writing about. Obviously, George Tenet knew about these things. George Tenet was told in mid-August that a terrorist suspect was trying to learn how to fly a jet airliner. And he was concerned enough that this was turned into a PowerPoint for internal purposes in the CIA. But when Tenet's asked, why didn't he do anything? Now, you have to consider this is in the context of all of those prior intelligence warnings. He just shrugs. So we never even got an answer from probably the person you would think is the most knowledgeable in this whole area. Maybe his answer was because the Bush administration didn't care. Maybe what is his truthful answer? Maybe his answer would have been because there were key neoconservatives who were planning something else and they didn't care. That's possible. But he's never been pushed to tell the truth of why he did nothing when he knew a terrorist suspect was already in custody in Minnesota learning to fly, and this is in the context of all of those prior warnings. That's incredible. So to the extent that the full truth has yet to come out, I agree. I don't have any evidence myself, of course, about and this is, of course, I'm in Minnesota, but I have no evidence, solid evidence, about planting of bombs in the World Trade Center or anything like that. None of this is ever came to my attention, what they would call a smoking gun. So when people talk about conspiracy theories and whatever, I think that we need to always look for solid evidence. And, this documentation that Eichenwald is talking about is solid evidence, and it's out there. And let's hope the public and the press now use some pressure to have these see the light of day.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious, isn't it, Colleen Rowley, that in the absence of the full truth, it's led to this kind of fevered speculation that borders on a kind of a cult. And the truth of the matter is that, I mean, I don't know whether it is the truth of the matter, but my assumption is that what Tenet and all of these people are doing, and particularly Bush and Cheney, is that they and Rice, Condoleezza Rice, who's something of a hero in Republican circles, they're essentially protecting their legacy by keeping this stuff under wraps, that it's not a question that they in any way let this happen, which is the main kind of truth of speculation. It seems much more likely that they are in fact getting a free pass and covering up their incompetence.
Well, I don't think they'll get a free pass forever. The truth does eventually, and history shows, does eventually come out. It's actually amazing to think that it wouldn't come out. I mean, if you were Condi, for instance, back in September when she would make these stupid statements, no one would ever think that a person would fly a plane into a building. I can't even imagine how her head could have been working, because she herself was involved in planning to prevent planes from flying into locations. If she was that dumb and she knew nothing of the history, then she should not have been a national security advisor. And yet she made those statements. If you think about the way deceit works with politicians, of course, another terrible example has nothing to do with this, but, you know, when Clinton slams his fist down and says, I did not have sex with that woman, and yet he has to really know that there must be some hard DNA evidence out there that would refute him. And of course, when that happens, the public completely loses its trust in our public officials' statements. So I think the truth will come out slowly. And I don't think that a lot of the speculation that gets too specific into theories, for instance, the theories about planting bombs and that type of thing, are helpful at all. I think that as an investigator, you've got to keep an open mind, and you have to look at what we really know. These warnings that came in that summer that were completely ignored for all different reasons, or claimed that they were never even read, sometimes even covered up. The Sybelle Edmonds book, Classified Woman, has some examples of translations in the FBI that were supposed to have gone to high-level officials that looked like they were simply covered up. And they were warnings, very specific warnings about bin Laden going to attack. So when you see the sum of all this evidence, as I think history will, I think the truth will eventually come out. And their legacy, I really would have a hard time believing that they're going to be able to maintain a sterling legacy in the face of what will be known.
Well, Colleen Riley, you served in the United States Embassy in Paris, France, as a FBI attaché, and I don't know whether it was the time when the Algerian terrorist group, the GIA, were caught by French intelligence planning to fly a passenger jet into the Eiffel Tower. But all this information preceded 9/11.
Yes, and the documents that were found about the, I think it was called the Bojinka plot, that involved Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's nephew, that was to fly a plane into the CIA. So again, and there are even, besides all of those specific plots, there had been instances of air safety instances where even people, mentally handicapped people, had tried to reach the cockpit. So for different reasons, just because they were deranged or whatever, there had been a fight inside a cockpit where they were wounded the pilot severely. And so now you can go back to FAA. My co-author, Bogdan Jakovic, who was part of the red team testing security at airports, had found the year before 9/11, that the security was terrible and that they could easily smuggle in weapons and especially with the Boston airport. And he had tried to make warnings about fixing security, and those were ignored. Again, they were different people, and there are different levels of people, but not everything goes all the way up to the Bush administration. But from the top down, a nonchalance and not caring attitude about this thing definitely had to come downwards as well. And the person at the top is the person who can order extra precautions, can order extra information sharing. Even if there had been communications from the Bush administration that people should be on the lookout for more warnings. Just imagine all the warnings we've gotten since 9/11. I mean, most of them might have been silly, the orange alerts, et cetera. But if there had even been a little bit of a concern from the top down, you know, these FBI officials who claim they never read the April 2001 memo, they probably would have read it because they would have been more conscientious, because they would have known that their bosses and superiors were concerned about this. And so, yes, a system works because of the top down is a big factor. And of course, it's even worse than realizing that 9/11 could have prevented if people had been more concerned and if people had taken the right precautions, et cetera. It's 11 years later. It's 11 years later, and these lessons have still not been learned. I don't believe that there still is the type of information sharing. In fact, secrecy from the public is at its apex. The Obama administration has actually, continued the secrecy. 92 million documents were classified last year, and now they're more worried about leaking, and they're giving thousands of polygraphs to analysts in the Pentagon. So all of what they're doing now is actually going back to the same environment of 9/11, risk-averse, not only risk-averse, but even averse to sharing of information with people.
Well, just in closing then, Colleen Rowley, it's pretty obvious that in the summer of 2001, particularly at the CIA, in the counterterrorism center at the CIA, the agents were quite apoplectic, and they kept sending these briefs to the White House warning about how an attack was imminent. And you also had on the FBI side, of course, John O'Neill, who was apparently one of the best agents that the FBI ever had, to my understanding. And he apparently really knew al-Qaeda and had the institutional knowledge, and he had butted heads with Louis Free, who was apparently, again, in that kind of complacent Bush mindset. Eventually, ironically, John O'Neill resigned from the FBI, was forced out, and ended up as head of security at the World Trade Center, and he died on 9/11. So not only do we not know the full story and that they're covering up an enormous amount of information, the stories within these stories themselves are so dramatic and tragic. And one, you know, wishes that some of those stories could get told, particularly the John O'Neill story.
Yeah, there were many good agents at lower levels. O'Neill was kind of a higher mid-level, but there were many agents. I mentioned the two in Minnesota, but there was a CIA female who passed this information on, made sure Tenet knew about it, etc. There were good people at the bottom, but they only were compartmentalized in what they knew. None of them knew the whole thing because information is supposed to flow up. And so somebody like a George Tenet is the one who really probably was privy to most of it. And so these good agents, a lot of times when they tried to get the truth out afterwards, were punished or forced to resign or retire. Not only John O'Neill before 9/11, but there were others. That story about why the CIA never told the truth to the FBI, there's an agent in there that was forced to resign. I don't know if there weren't other things involved, but I know that there's another agent in there in that story who was forced to resign. Meanwhile, the lower levels, the whistleblowers, were punished for telling the truth, still are being punished under the Obama administration, by the way. And the highest levels, the ones who did these terrible things, and let's use George Tenet, who went along with everything and gave false presentations and covered up, he goes on to write a book for $4 million, and he's teaching at Georgetown. And so Condi Rice is teaching at Stanford. The authors of the torture memos are law professors out there. I mean, you can go on and on, but if you went along with this really bad, deceitful system, you were rewarded and you were given promotions. If you balked about it, told the truth, you were punished or retaliated against. And that's one of the key fixes that Obama promised before he became president. He knew that, and he was insistent that whistleblowers would not be punished. And he thought it was a good thing for the public to learn the truth. He gave speeches like this. And of course, when the shoe's on the other foot, 3 years later, he's turned almost into the opposite. He's prosecuting whistleblowers. He's ordered polygraphs for the Pentagon. They're doing all this tracking of leaking, and it's a terrible situation to watch happen, because none of these solutions, most of them are pretty easy solutions as opposed to launching wars, etc., have, as far as I can see, have not even been 11 years later put into place.
Well, Colleen Rowley, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Yes, thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Colleen Rowley, a former FBI special agent who investigated Italian organized crime and Sicilian heroin smuggling. And then in 1990, she was transferred to Minneapolis. And along with other agents there, she pushed to investigate the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. And in 2002, she brought some of the pre-9/11 lapses to light and testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee about endemic problems facing the FBI and the intelligence community. Time magazine named her and two other whistleblowers Persons of the Year. She retired from the FBI in 2004 and now speaks publicly on ethical decision-making and balancing civil liberties with the need for effective investigation. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back and go to Moscow to talk to an editor of a magazine who got fired for not covering Putin's flight with the cranes. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Moscow is Masha Gessen, a journalist and author of several books. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granter, and Slate, among other publications, and served as editor of the Russian language magazine Snob, and was recently fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with cranes. Her latest book is The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. So tell us about what happened in terms of you're losing this job over Putin's stunt of flying the ultralight craft with the cranes.
Basically, I refused to send a reporter. And the reason I actually refused to send the reporter is because previous Putin efforts at saving extinct species have generally involved endangering the animals, mostly because special animals have to be to participate, and anything is done to enhance the photo op without regard for the animals. So, for example, when he was putting a satellite collar on a tiger, it actually then turned out to be a tiger borrowed from the Khabarovsk Zoo, not a wild tiger as it was built. When he was putting a satellite collar on a polar bear that was captured several days ahead of time and heavily sedated while waiting for Putin. So I actually didn't want my reporters to see something like that, because then we would feel obligated to report it, and then we would get in trouble, and the publisher would probably lose his magazine. I felt that as a popular science magazine, which is what Around the World is, it's actually the second oldest popular science magazine in the world, we would be able to sidestep the issue altogether as long as we weren't forced to see what Putin did. So that's why I didn't send a reporter, and when my publisher encountered my refusal to send a reporter, he fired me on the spot.
So, Masha Gessen, what it seems to me, though, there's a kind of irony here, and I think you could actually suggest an absurdity here, that Vladimir Putin is freeing animals while imprisoning the Russian people.
Well, I think it's everything he does is a travesty, and you don't even have to go so far as to look at people. You can just look at nature. He's making a show of saving nature while also running an extractive oil economy. In which there's no regard for the environment. The amount of oil that Russia's leading companies, and including partly state-owned companies, spill into Russia's water supplies are absolutely staggering. It's like, we have the BP disaster happening on an annual basis, and it's absolute hypocrisy in that context to make a show of trying to save Siberian cranes.
So again, Masha Gessen is a journalist, author, and editor speaking to us from Moscow. She was recently fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with cranes, and her latest book is The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. At his press conference in Vladivostok following the APEC summit, Putin was mocking and derisive towards critics of him like yourself, and deriding them as being out of the mainstream, odd ducks, perhaps, or dodos. What else can be said? There are certain birds that don't fly in flocks. But this is a different sort of problem. Even if they are not members of the flock, they are members of our population, and they have to be treated very carefully to the extent possible. Now, that is a very spooky, to my mind, that is a spooky kind of threat to any dissident, that patronizing nature is the nicest thing you could say about it. But given what your book has revealed, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, I find it deeply chilling, and I imagine you do.
I do.
I'm
not comfortable commenting on this right at this minute.
Okay.
It will It'll become clear in a couple of days why I'm not. But
okay. Well,
but I can do that right now.
But it's pretty clear that that there's many moves on the part of both the parliament and President Putin to restrict the activity of protesters and dissidents in Russia. I mean, that's no secret.
Absolutely not. I mean, we've been living ever since he entered office for the third time, for the third time in the last 12 years. He has been leading a progressive crackdown. There has been a whole bunch of repressive laws passed. There are more than a dozen people who've been imprisoned in connection with peaceful protest activities. And that shows no sign of stopping. It's very rapidly progressed from a repressive authoritarian regime to tyranny, basically.
So has there been a lot of publicity within Russia about the findings from Boris Nemtsov about the extent of Putin's wealth and his lavish lifestyle? Obviously, that's not in the story that the official press is going to cover, but I'm just curious to know whether the alternative press and the internet is getting that story out.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Ian, I'm going to beg again, because I have nothing good to say about that report. I'm sorry, so I'd rather not say anything.
Okay.
It's just horribly written and very poorly researched.
I see. Well, I certainly, there's enough real evidence out there that one doesn't have to resort to shoddy reports. But and Navalny is under in trouble, though, isn't he? And they seem to be going after him.
Yes, absolutely. Navalny is Russia's most prominent anti-corruption activist. Is facing charges and could quite possibly face up to 7 years in prison. So he's got the sword hanging over him, and it will be lowered eventually.
Well, what is the, Hillary Clinton met with Putin at Vladivostok, and they talked obviously about Syria, and they came away with deep disagreements about how to proceed. But when asked about her meeting with Putin, and she was asked about the cranes, of course, and she sort of laughed and said, he's quite a character. Do you get the impression that foreign leaders, and particularly leaders here in the United States, have the full measure of who Putin is?
As a matter of fact, I don't. I think that they certainly have come a long way from the apparent admiration they felt for him in his early years in power. And they increasingly find him disagreeable and ridiculous. But I don't think they quite realize just how much of a dictator he's become.
Well, it's pretty hard not to see it, though, isn't it? I mean, 50,000-plus people in the streets. Even though the authorities have found ways to suppress dissent, I take it it's still bubbling under the surface.
It's certainly bubbling under the, well, not just under the surface, it's bubbling over all the time. There's a large demonstration planned for this Saturday. I have a feeling that it'll be smaller than some previous demonstrations, and part of the reason that it'll be smaller, of course, is that the risks of going out into the streets, even to take part in a perfectly legal, peaceful protest, have become quite high. It's one thing to go out into the street when you can plan on going to work the next day. It's quite another to feel that you may not see your family for 2 or 3 years.
Which is what happened with the punk rock group Pussy Riot, at least.
Right. Well, the punk rock group didn't take part in a legal protest.
Right.
It was still a peaceful protest for which they got 2 years in prison. But there are more than a dozen people imprisoned in connection with the last legally sanctioned protest in Moscow, and that's I think the scary part for a lot of potential participants in Saturday's protest.
Well, Masha Gessen, I thank you so much for joining us here, and I certainly don't mean to put you on the spot, but I admire what you're trying to do, and I hope to stay in touch.
There's no problem at all. There's a couple of things that I need to say, but
okay, yep. I understand.
Right now, it's not,
Sure.
Yeah.
Again, I've been speaking with Marcia Gessen, who's a journalist and author of several books. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granter and Slate, among other publications, and she served as editor of the Russian language magazine Snob and was recently fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Putin's stunt of flying with the cranes. Her latest book is The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, and she joined us from Moscow. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about how the banking lobby is trying to undo Wall Street reform.
Air feels good to say what I want to knock things down. Air feels good to see this love.
Get from out the road when he get dough, it's horrible. Time is money, spend, wait, save, invest, affest. The 10K, so cave a chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all are dumb and get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he bout to change the price again. It go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, albums shrilling in fear. It won't stop, top bill until he a gazillionaire. Took a Jehovah money for an Arabic Torah. Charged in advance, translated and ignored us, sorta.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Amit Narang, who is Public Citizens Regulatory Policy Advocate and the editor of the Administrative Law Review, a widely circulated legal journal focused on regulatory law and policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amit Narang.
Thank you very much, Ian, for having me on.
And under the radar, lawmakers are pushing a bill that would curb the influence of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, and the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, all in the name of reform. Of course, by and large, most of these pernicious bills are aimed at reform, are they not? But I take it your analysis indicates quite the opposite.
Well, that's right. The so-called reforms to the financial reform law that are being offered in Congress by Republicans have often taken the form of further delay, further analysis of the so-called costs and benefits of financial reform, despite the obvious benefit of avoiding the next massive financial collapse. So these are reforms in name only.
But since Dodd-Frank was first floated, if you will, it's been under assault. And there have been relentless efforts by the banking lobby to water it down. And this appears to be the latest one with this Senate bill authored by Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, and Susan Collin, Republican of Maine, and also with the support of the Democrat Mark Warner of Virginia. I take it that by sending this or assigning this bill to the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs, which is overseen by Joseph Lieberman, they think they've got a way to fast-track it into law. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. What's very different about this piece of legislation is that it's being considered, seriously considered, in the Senate first rather than the House. We've seen quite a few Dodd-Frank slowdown or shutdown bills in the House that have passed easily, frankly, but have gone nowhere in the Senate. This time it's the opposite. There's a chance that this bill will pass in the Senate first, and then we know that passage in the House is a foregone conclusion. As of this date, over two-thirds of the financial reforms supposed to be instituted under Dodd-Frank have not been established. That's 2.5 years after the law was passed and almost 4 years after the financial crisis itself, and this bill is only going to add further delays and also present the potential for a future White House that is opposed to financial reform or opposed to particular agencies. I'll use the CFPB as an example, since they've been fairly controversial in some quarters since their inception. It allows a future White House the tools to effectively shut down the remaining Dodd-Frank rules to be implemented.
But it seems to be the tactic that's used, even though it's all being couched under the rubric of reform, the tactic is to open the door for legal challenges, isn't it? That's what happened at the Consumer CFTC, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Didn't they basically sue the CFTC into a dead halt?
That's right. The financial industry has been very active suing the financial agencies, the CFTC, but also the SEC, potentially in the future the CFPB, for on the basis of their rules not being adequately justified on the basis of the rules' costs and benefits. So basically what industry is saying is that the cost of these financial reforms to regulated industries, i.e. the financial industry, outweighs the benefit to the public. And it's disappointing to see that this rhetoric, but also these legal cases, have gained quite a bit of traction. They've already netted one victory in court, and it's only spawned more lawsuits. What this bill capitalizes on the cost-benefit attacks on financial reform. It basically allows a future White House to say to one of these independent financial agencies, your cost-benefit analysis on any particular regulation is wrong, and you have a couple of options. You can either go back to the drawing board with your cost-benefit analysis, you can withdraw your rule, or you can go ahead and finalize the rule despite our assessment that you've done a bad job with the cost-benefit analysis. The problem for the agency, if they want to go ahead and finalize the rule, is that they're going to be submitted to the same kind of lawsuit that they've already seen. And this time, they have a White House, they have a strong piece of evidence in a White House assessment that an agency has done a bad job of cost-benefit analysis. And, for many, cost-benefit analysis seems to be a useful tool in theory. What we see is that in practice, it's far less useful and is a very dangerous concept to use in justifying regulations. I can give you a good recent example, if you'd like.
Go ahead.
Recently, the Federal Aviation Administration tried to finalize a safety regulation where they limited their pilots from being in the air for too many hours, basically. They wanted to have some time duty limits. And when the White House reviewed the economic analyses underlying the rule, they said, well, for commercial pilots, this seems fine. But for cargo pilots, we don't think this regulation is necessary. And they said that the costs and the benefits in that case did not justify the rule. Basically, what they said is that the benefits of avoiding a crash for cargo pilots were too low because there hadn't been that many incidences of cargo fatalities. And the fact that cargo planes carry mostly cargo and very few human lives would mean that the human lives lost in a cargo plane crash would be lower, so the benefits would be lower, and don't justify the costs. It's a pretty striking example, I think, of the flawed approach to justifying safety regulations on the basis of cost benefit.
Well, that reform, though, the real reform in the FAA came as a result of a plane crash in upstate New York where the pilots had been working too long hours. And the idea that the aviation industry could step in and change rules that impact human life in that cynical way is pretty breathtaking, I must admit. Again, I'm speaking with Amit Narang, who's Public Citizens Regulatory Policy Advocate and the editor of the Administrative Law Review, a widely circulated legal journal focusing on regulatory law and policy. And we're talking about efforts to undermine the Dodd-Frank Act, most of which has still been stalled since it passed a couple of years ago. And this latest assault comes from a group of senators led by Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, and Democrat Mark Warner of Virginia. They're pushing the bill through the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs, overseen by Joseph Lieberman. And what's also extraordinary about this, Amit, is that the Congress has balked before granting the White House such authority as this bill indicates. It's almost like a reflex on the part of the Congress not to give the White House that kind of power. So the idea that they're handing this power over flies in the face of the logic of the separation of powers, doesn't it?
That's right. Congress has traditionally jealously guarded oversight of independent agencies and, push back against attempts to expand that influence to the White House. Even Senator Susan Collins herself in 2009, in a hearing, expressed strong reservations about any kind of legislative proposal that would allow the White House to review independent agency regulations and their economic analyses in particular. So it's surprising that in just a few short years, Senator Collins has done a 180 on this particular issue.
So what explains this? Is this all about the power of the banking lobby, Amit Narang?
I'd say so. I mean, this bill is a recipe for, you know, preservation of the status quo on Wall Street, which is basically Wall Street policing itself, regulating itself. Like I said, over two-thirds of financial reform has yet to be put in place. And so the kind of self-regulation that reigned on Wall Street before the financial collapse largely still reigns. And we know what kind of effect that had on Main Street.
So how do they sell it to these legislators? Assuming that they're not totally corrupt and completely in the pocket of the Wall Street banking lobby, I mean, what are their arguments? Or is this purely a case of quid pro quo? You know, we give you a campaign money and you give us what we want.
Well, one trick they use is to try to bury the impact on particular financial agencies and on Wall Street reform. Specifically, nobody is calling this, you know, the Wall Street slowdown or shutdown bill. They are arguing that this will bring, you know, better metrics for agencies to use when they put forward regulations. But it should be noted that nobody is arguing that this is going to speed up or expedite the process of getting these overdue financial reforms in place. This is definitely a case of putting, additional burdens on agencies, financial agencies, trying to implement what Congress wants them to do, which is financial reform in the wake of the Wall Street economic collapse. You know, in this instance, we're seeing a real effort to use the term or use the phrase job-killing regulations to hide a very specific agenda to roll back much-needed financial reforms.
Again, I'm speaking with Amit Narang, Public Citizens Regulatory Policy Advocate and the editor of the Administrative Law Review, a widely circulated legal journal focusing on regulatory law and policy. Well, we've seen the assault from day one against the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and efforts on the part of Congress to not allow its newly appointed head to have the authority that was necessary. Another trick, you know, I guess under the rubric of the fine print, all in the name of reform, was the idea that they wanted to make it more like the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, which is a 5-member board, as opposed to having a kind of czar, if you will, in charge who can actually get things done. That seems to be another trick they use. I'm just surprised that the public aren't more outraged at these shenanigans, which really, given the extent to which the taxpayer made these bankers whole, and now they're bigger and more powerful than ever. And meanwhile, as we can tell from the election narrative that's going on now, Main Street is not whole, and Main Street's hurting, Wall Street's rolling in dough, and it's just an obscene situation. And I'm just amazed that I'm glad that you and Public Citizens are shining a light on this, but I just don't get the impression that there's sufficient scrutiny going on of this kind of mendacity.
The public should be outraged. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is, you know, a common sense financial agency in the best interest of protecting consumer interests with respect to financial products. These are complicated products. Consumers were being taken advantage of wholesale before the financial crisis. Abusive and deceptive practices by credit card companies, by mortgage lenders, were taking place across the country. And so the need for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and their reforms is greater than ever. The outlandish claims that the Bureau would act like a czar were much overblown, and the fact is that if this legislation passes, the czar is going to be in the White House overseeing the bureau, not at the bureau imposing, you know, burdens on the public, as many will claim. You know, I'm with you on this one, Ian. I don't see how you can make a strong case against the, you know, common sense financial protections and a common sense agency that's acting in the best interest for the first time on behalf of, you know, financial consumers for financial products.
So, given that this is unusual, this bill is being generated in the Senate, and the House will rubber stamp it because they have done everything they could to undermine Dodd-Frank from day one. What's likely to happen then if they do pass it, and what will the president do? Because last spring, the president signed the so-called Jobs Act, Jumpstart Our Business Startups. And I interviewed a number of analysts at the time about that, and they said this thing was just an absolute outrage. It was full of, it was an invitation to fraud, where all kinds of flim-flam public offerings could even be done over the internet, you know? And why did Obama pass that? And is he likely to veto this thing if it gets into law?
You're very right that the Jobs Act provides the kind of template for what we're most concerned about in this case. We definitely don't want a Jobs Act redux. I think that there is a certain degree of buyer's remorse also with the Jobs Act that shouldn't be overlooked. In this case, you know, we feel that having the Senate approve this legislation on a bipartisan basis will make it very difficult for the president to oppose it. He would basically be out on his own. Now, he would have good reason to oppose it because one of his signature achievements, the Dodd-Frank financial reform law, would very much be in jeopardy, along with the CFPB, which is, you know, another signature achievement, rightly so, of the administration's. But it's hard to see a bill potentially passing the Senate as an amendment, potentially on some must-pass piece of legislation during the lame duck session. That's really what we're worried about here the most. It's hard to see that bill being vetoed by the president, but we'd very much hope the president would be in a position to do that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Amit Narang.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Amit Narang, who is the Public Citizens Regulatory Policy Advocate and editor of the Administrative Law Review, a widely circulated legal journal focusing on regulatory law and policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.